thank you so much. I want to welcome everybody. Oklahoma City, Edmond, Mayfair, Community Center, prisons, Bethany Children's Hospital, folks online. I've just been looking forward to coming to church this week. After everything going on in our country, it felt like to come here and be reminded our fate lies not in the hands of any political process. There is one on the throne in heaven, and he can be trusted, and we're in his hands. And so, Crossings into the series on the parables. I'll get to a parable, but I want to start here. The psalmist has a profound request of God. Psalm 90, verse 12. Teach us to number our days so that we gain a heart of wisdom. And for some reason, we have such a hard time doing that. Most people I know have good intentions. We want to be the right kind of people. We want to love folks. We want to be generous. And yet we find ourselves missing out on life for reasons that are hard to even articulate, often because we're in such a hurry that we don't even know it. In the Bay Area where I used to live, there's a guy named Meyer Friedman. He's the guy that coined the phrase type A personality. And he said that we suffer from what he calls hurry sickness. It's like an epidemic. It's like we worship speed without even knowing why. For instance, a while ago, I read an interview with a Domino's pizza driver. Some of you might remember Domino's became the number one seller of pizzas in America when they made a promise, we will deliver the pizza to your home within 30 minutes or it's free. And in his interview, the driver said that when he would drive for Domino's, when he would get in his car with a little Domino's sign and get on the road, other drivers would pull over to the side of the road to let him go past. Like we used to do for ambulances and fire trucks. We don't do it for them anymore. We do it for the Domino's guy because we worship speed. The CEO of Domino's, I'm not making this up, said, we don't sell pizzas, we sell delivery. And if you've ever had a Domino's pizza, you know. So then, influenced by that, this is an article in USA Today. Taking a cue from Domino's Pizza, a Detroit hospital guarantees that emergency room patients will be seen within 20 minutes or treatment is free. So far, Doctors Hospital has delivered since the offer was made, June 24, cable TV, business has been up 30%. Mortality rate's up 90%, but they don't really care. People in and out in a hurry. I was part of a survey one time asking, what keeps you from knowing God? Becoming the kind of person that you know God wants you to be. The number one barrier people cited for their spiritual growth, I don't have enough time. I'm in too much of a hurry to get to know God. So just to level the playing field, so this gets beyond information, I thought this would be a good weekend to do a mass confession of hurry sickness. If you think you might suffer from this epidemic, I'm going to ask you to raise your hand publicly in front of all these other people here. Not yet. Hang on. See, this is what I'm talking about right here. Don't waste my time. We know where you're going. Just humor me for a minute. We describe it a little bit. If you suffer from this disease, you feel like there's never enough time in the day. You're a multitasker, cram stuff in. When you come to a stoplight, if there are two lanes, one car in each lane, you find yourself guessing based on the make, model, and year of each car, which car is going to pull away fastest. Because God forbid you should get behind the slower car in that moment. If you have this disease and you're in the grocery store, and if there are two lines that you can get in, you find yourself counting how many people in each line multiplied by how many items in each cart. And if you're really sick, when you get into line A, you keep track of the person that would have been you in line B. And if that person gets out and you're still in line, you're depressed the whole rest of the day because you lost the line count. Okay, now that you know what it is, just raise your hand for a minute. How many of you suffer? Now, keep those hands raised. Just keep them real high. Wherever you are, whatever side, this is a sick church. I'm just telling you. Dad would come home from work every day. Every day he would bring his briefcase. And this troubled his son because his son just wanted to be with his dad. And he finally said to him, Dad, how come you bring your briefcase home every day? And his dad answered, well, son, I can't get all my work done at the office. And his son said, Dad, can't they put you in a slower group? And we don't offer that slower group option very much in our world. Teach us to number our day. Life just goes so fast. Children grow so fast. Opportunities pass. Now, Jesus wanted to talk about our tendency to miss, to be diverted by stuff that doesn't really matter from what matters the most, from a heart full of wisdom. And in typical fashion, he told the story. I heard a preacher once, Haddon Robinson, retell it in modern terms. So inspired by that, that's what I want to try to do. But this is Jesus' story, and you can find it in the Gospel of Luke, the 12th chapter. I'd encourage you to read it and reflect on it for a while and think about my life, your life, in light of it. Once in Oklahoma City, there lived a busy, important man. He was the CEO of an agribusiness conglomerate. He put in 12, 14-hour days quite regularly, joined boards, went on LinkedIn and Instagram and TikTok to expand his influence. Even when he wasn't working, he was thinking about work. So it wasn't just his occupation, it was his preoccupation. His wife tried to slow him down, reminded him he had a family. He was vaguely aware the kids were growing up. He was missing it. From time to time, they would complain to him about games of catch they were not playing or books that he was not reading. But after a while, they stopped complaining because they stopped expecting it would ever change. "I'll be more available to them in 6 months or so when things settle down," said the man in Jesus' story. And although he was a real smart guy, he didn't seem to notice that things never actually settled down. Besides, he would tell himself when he felt guilty, "I'm doing it all for them." He knew he was not taking great care of his body or of his soul. His doctor told him he had some serious warning signs, elevated blood pressure and cholesterol. His wife reminded him, "There's a great church just down the road." And he fully intended to get around to those things in 6 months or so when things settled down. One day, the CFO of his company came to him and said, "You won't believe what's happening, but things are booming so much right now that we can't keep up. It's like we've hit the mother lode. Business is exploding, but it's gonna require major changes. Demand is outstripping, you know, our ability to meet it. Supply chain issues are killing us. If we don't have a major restructure, it's gonna be a train wreck." And from that moment on, this guy in Jesus' story is like a man obsessed. And then it hit him. He would put his company and his personal finances through a technological revolution, replace the whole staff with chatbots and artificial intelligence, invest in untraceable offshore tariff-free Bitcoin that would give him controlling interest in NVIDIA, Apple, Google, Chick-fil-A, and the world champion Oklahoma City Thunder. And no, don't applaud, please. This is not. He said to his wife that night, "You know what this means. Once I do this, we'll be set for life. We can finally take that vacation you always pester me about. We can relax." But his wife had heard that kind of thing before. She didn't get her hopes up. About 11 o'clock that night, she asked him if he was coming to bed. "Yeah, you go ahead. I'll be there in a minute or so. Just got a couple things to finish up. You go ahead." 2 o'clock in the morning, she wakes up and he's still not in bed. So she went downstairs and she saw him from behind, still in front of his computer, his head resting on his arm, and she shook her head. "It's like being married to a kid. He'd rather fall asleep in front of a screen than come up to bed." And she reached out to touch him on the arm to wake him up and bring him to bed, but his skin was cold when she touched him. And when the paramedics got there, he'd been dead for hours. The man in Jesus' story. Because of his prominence, his death was a major story in the financial community, and it was written up all over the place, online, Forbes, the Journal, and it's too bad he was dead because he would have loved the things that got written about him. And because of his prominence, they had a real big service for him. And they all file past his casket. They all make the same stupid comment that people always make when they go to a funeral service. They say, "He looks so peaceful." Rigor mortis will do that to you. And then they eulogize him. because he was such a great guy, such an amazing wife. He was an influencer, one guy says. He's a master of social media. He was a visionary, says somebody else, an entrepreneur. He was a pillar in the community, somebody else says. He was a networker. He knew everybody. And they erect a monument to him, and they write all these inspiring words on it: visionary, entrepreneur, influencer, leader, above all, success. That's the word, success. He was a success. And then they all go home. And when it was dark and there was no one around, the angel of God came to that cemetery and, unseen, unheard, writes, traces with a finger the single word that God used to summarize this rich guy's life from God's perspective. Anybody know what that word was? Fool. You fool. This night your life will be required of you. Now who will get all those things you stored up for yourselves? You understand, Jesus was not being mean when he told this story, although it hurts us maybe a bit to hear it. He was just describing what can happen to a life just through folly. He doesn't say evil or wicked or mean or just fool. Two great illusions that rich fools suffer from. One of them is wrapped up in that little phrase, when things settle down. When things settle down, someday I'm going to really get around to what matters the most, and I'll be the kind of person, kind of dad, kind of friend, kind of giver, kind of person of compassion that I know, but I can't yet. I can't today. I can't right now. Let me ask you a question. When will things settle down? The answer is when you die, okay? You'll be amazed how much your life slows down when you actually die. Just pace goes way, way down. I've seen it before. I'm a professional. I've watched this. Then your calendar is going to empty. Maybe not a whole lot till then. Many years ago, when I had moved to Chicago and was working at a church where there was a lot going on, and we had small kids in our family and life was getting real full, I called the wisest person I know about spiritual life issues, a man named Dallas Willard. And I described my life and I asked him, Dallas, what do I need to do to stay spiritually healthy and vital with God? And there was a long pause. Always with Dallas, there would be a long pause. And then he said the sentence that I will never forget as long as I live. He said, you must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. And then there was another long pause. And then I said, okay, I got that one. Now what else have you got? Because I don't have a lot of time and I need as much wisdom from you as I can get. And he said, no, there's nothing else. He said, hurry is the great enemy of spiritual life in our day. Because it doesn't look evil. It doesn't look wicked. It'll just pull you away from God and the person that you were supposed to be. He said, there's a difference between being busy and being hurried. Being busy is to have many things to do. That's a condition of our bodies. Jesus was often quite busy. Being hurried is a condition of the soul. It's where I become so wrapped up, so preoccupied with me and my little agenda and my goals and what I gotta have, what I gotta acquire, get my own way, that I am unable anymore in this moment right here to be fully present to God who is here and fully present with whoever I'm with. You must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. No one else will do this for you. The time fairy is not going to come along and sprinkle time dust over your life. Your boss will not do this. Your spouse, if you have one, will not do this. Your kids, if you must do this, Dallas said to me. That's the first illusion, when things settle down. And the second illusion is like it. One day, more will be enough. Not there yet, but one day, we're bombarded with this message. You are not or should not be content right now, but contentment is just one acquisition away. Use me, try me, buy me, wear me, eat me, put me in your hair, then you'll be content. Not today, I know. And of course, wisdom always teaches us that between more, and enough is a chasm that will never be bridged. I'll give you a real simple proof. Who is more content, the man with $12 million or the man with 12 children? And the answer is the man with 12 children, because he doesn't want any more. You don't actually need to applaud for that one either, actually. The Apostle Paul has such a remarkable statement when he writes to the church at Philippi. He says, I have learned the secret of being content. In other words, contentment is not going to come someday when I finally get enough and things settle down. It is a learned skill. I've learned the secret. When I live with Jesus richly present together with me, with him and for him. I'll give you a little phrase that you can take away today that will help us all with this one. You know the comic strip Peanuts, Charlie Brown? So one time it's Thanksgiving, Snoopy's on top of his doghouse, and he's kind of sour because Charlie and the family are inside having turkey and mashed potatoes and cranberry sauce, and he's not happy about this till a thought occurs to him, it could be worse, I could have been born a turkey. And I want us to take that phrase today, so let's say it together out loud. It could be worse. Here's how you're going to use this. When you leave church today, wherever you are, you will go get into some vehicle to go home. You're going to be tempted to think, I would be content if I had a nicer, newer, bigger, more expensive vehicle. But instead, today, when you get into that vehicle, you're going to say, with great passion and conviction, you're going to say, it could be worse. Then you're going to go to wherever you live, your apartment, your house. You're going to be tempted to think, if I just had that nicer, newer, bigger, more expensive, really cool, high-tech place to live, I'd be happy. But not today. Today, you're going to walk across that door and say, it could be worse. Tomorrow morning, when you wake up and roll over, you're married, you see your spouse, you're going to say, no, don't do that one. Don't do that one. There's a theologian, Miroslav Volf, he makes a wonderful distinction. He says, there's a big difference between richness of having more money, having more cars, having more status, having more prestige, having more success, and richness of being rich in love, being rich in friends, being rich in compassion. And the reason we want richness of having is we think it will get us to richness of being, but because it won't. For a real good reason, and I'll tell you another story around this one. It's kind of another version of Jesus' story. It involves an analogy I heard first from a psychologist, James Dobson, that reminded me of playing Monopoly. Anybody here ever play Monopoly or used to? Board games, not so big anymore, but I grew up playing Monopoly with my grandmother. She was a wonderful woman, great storyteller, really fun person. We loved her, but she was the most ruthless Monopoly player I have ever met. Imagine that Attila the Hun married Cruella de Vil and they had a child, and that'll give you a picture of how my grandmother played. So we'd play, and I'd get my little stack of play money, and I just want to hold on to it. But not her. She knew how to play the game. That money is how you keep score. That acquiring more is how you win. So she would buy every piece of property that she would land on, and then she would mortgage that to the hilt and then buy everything else that she could. And inevitably, she would become the master of the board, just own the whole darn thing. And sooner or later, I would land on whatever properties, and I would have to give her my last dollar and quit in utter defeat. And she would always shake her head and say, Don't worry about it, Johnny. Someday you'll learn how to play the game. I hated it when she would say that to me. And then one summer, I played almost every day in a kid that lived kitty corner from our house on Flores Drive in Rockford. And that was the summer when it gradually dawned on me how to play the game. That summer I learned money's how you keep score. You got to acquire every single thing that you can get, every man for himself. I learned that summer to be master of the board. So by the time fall rolled around, I was ready to do whatever it took to beat my grandmother. I was more ruthless than she was. I played with sweaty palms. I was ready to cheat if I needed to in order to beat my grandmother at Monopoly. Slowly, cunningly, I exposed the soft underbelly of my grandmother's weakness. Relentlessly, inexorably, I drove her off the board. The game does strange things to you. I can still remember. It happened at Marvin Gardens. I looked at my grandmother, who was an old lady by then. She was a widow. She had raised six children. She raised my mom. She loved my mom. She loved me. She taught me how to play the game. I took everything she had. I destroyed her financially and psychologically. I watched her give me her last dollar and quit in utter defeat. It was the greatest moment of my life. And then she had one more lesson to teach me. She said, "Now, Johnny, it all goes back in the box. All that money, that wonderful money, all those houses, all those hotels, all that wonderful property, now it all goes back in the box." I didn't want it to go back in the box. I wanted to leave the board out, maybe bronze it as a memorial to myself, because I had finally become master of the board. Real smart guys forget this. It's kind of a Southern cookbook called Death Warmed Over that starts with a story I love about a man who's dying at home in his bed. And he could smell the aroma of chocolate chip cookies, his favorite, baking downstairs. And he wanted one more chocolate chip cookie before he died. So he dragged his body out of bed, rolled downstairs, crawled into the kitchen, reached a trembling hand up to grasp one final cookie when he felt the sting of a spatula smack his hand. "Put that back," his wife said. "They're for the funeral." Ask not for whom the spatula wax. It wax for thee. He was a smart guy, the guy in Jesus' story. He learned to play the game and he played it really well. He only forgot one tiny little detail. He forgot the game would end. The game always ends. He forgot what would happen to all that stuff. So God says, "You fool. What other word would you use to describe a person who is so busy making a living that he forgets that this is his one and only life?" And the thing is, you don't even have to believe the Bible to see this. Just look around. Somebody described this famous person quite a while ago. This person died some time ago. You might recognize him, might not. All he ever wanted was more, is the description. He wanted more money, so he parlayed inherited wealth into $1 billion pile of assets. He wanted more fame, so he broke into the Hollywood scene, became a filmmaker and star. He wanted more sensual pleasures, so he paid handsome sums to indulge his every urge. He wanted more thrills, so he designed, built, and piloted the fastest airplane in the world. He wanted more power, so he secretly dealt political favors so skillfully that two U.S. presidents became his pawns. All he ever wanted was more. He was absolutely convinced that more would bring him true satisfaction. This is how he ended his life: emaciated, colorless, sunken chest, fingernails in grotesque inches-long corkscrews, rotting black teeth, tumors, innumerable needle marks from his drug addiction. Anybody know who that was? Howard Hughes died believing the myth of more. A billionaire junkie, insane by all reasonable standards. Here's the question you have to ask yourself. If he'd have made one more million, if he'd have pulled off one more deal, if he'd have had one more thrill, would that have been enough? She was the most adulated of women. Every woman envied her. Every man wanted her. She had beauty, money, fame, power, but she died alone. She died at her own hand. If Marilyn Monroe had had one more hit movie, one more magazine cover, one more relationship with a powerful man, would that have been enough? Would that have filled the heart? If my wife Nancy and I were to have a conversation and agree, she could go to the mall, take the credit card, spend in one day unlimited shopping, buy every dress, every pair of shoes, every piece of jewelry that her heart desires, would it be enough? Well, we'll never know. I don't care what you believe. Walk down that road as far as you want to walk. There's a cul-de-sac and a little box at the end of it. That's the lesson of the box. This is by a theologian named Jerry Seinfeld. To me, if life boils down to one significant thing, it's movement. To live is to keep moving. Unfortunately, this means for the rest of our lives, we're going to be looking for boxes. When you're moving, your whole world is boxes. That's all you think about, boxes. Where are the boxes? You wander down the street, going in and out of stores. Are there boxes here? Do you have any boxes? That's all you think about. You could be at a funeral. Everyone around you is mourning, crying. You're looking at the casket. That's a nice box. Anybody know where that guy got that box? When he's done with it, think I could use it? It's got some real nice handles on it. My stereo would fit right in there. I mean, that's what death is, really. The last big move of your life. The hearse is like the van. The pallbearers are your close friends, the only ones you could ask you to help with a big move like that. And the casket is that great, perfect box you've been looking for your whole life on. Because when the game is over. So Jesus says, it's like this for everybody that piles up stuff for themselves and is not rich towards God. How do you be rich toward God? Well, of course, we all know. It's just love. It's just a life designed around love, which means a life designed around giving. God so loved the world, he gave. He gave what was most precious to him. That's what it is to be rich toward God, just a life of giving in love. Think about Crossings and all the remarkable things that God has done and ways that God has blessed this church. What would happen to Oklahoma City if everybody at Crossings said, my ultimate goal now for the rest of my life starting today is to be rich toward God. God, you've given me so much, wherever I am, whatever it looks like to anybody else. You gave me this great gift today. I woke up and I got to pass go and get $200. Take another trip around the board. God, I'm going to surrender. I'm not going to wait anymore for things to settle down, to spend my one and only life day by day with the people that I love the most, the resources that you have given to me, where they can count not for temporal stuff, but for what is eternal, for God and for people. Oh, gosh. Wise people remember, you know, the gift today is we're still in the game. The truth today is one day the game will be over, and when the game is over, it all goes back in the box. Be rich toward God. I'm going to pray, and I want to invite prayer teams at all the locations to come forward, and if it would be a helpful thing, folks would love to pray with you. Would you join me in prayer? Oh God, such stupid, foolish stuff gets a hold of us and blinds us. And it becomes so easy in our world to succumb to the magnetic pull of just stuff. and desire and more. Would you help everybody listening to these words to remember the story of Jesus, to remember the God who gives what is most valued by him for us. Help us, God, to be rich toward you. Would your Spirit do that work right now? In Jesus' name, amen. Thanks very much.